Our guest this morning, Professor Mohan LeMay, was born in Pune, which is near Mumbai, what we once knew as Bombay. Grew up in India, had the joy of studying Sanskrit from the ninth grade through his Master of Arts degree. I studied Sanskrit intensively for a year and got nowhere. Panini says, the ancient grammarian, says that it takes 36 years to master Sanskrit. I can believe that, still working on English myself. After his MA, he came on a Fulbright scholarship to the United States, where he studied at the University of Michigan, University of Wisconsin, and took a PhD in Renaissance literature, English Renaissance literature. He has been a teacher at BSU for many years, and we're very fortunate because here we have somebody who learned a religion the way most people do, by growing up in it, rather than simply from some distant point studying it. So we welcome Professor Mohan LeMay.
Well, thank you, Elton, for that introduction. I was going to say, actually, it is Elton who should be here, because I don't have a degree in theology or comparative religion. But as you said, that I was born a Hindu and was brought up a Hindu. So my perspective would be the perspective of a person who was born to it but doesn't know much about it. And that's really what most Hindus really are. They really don't know much about it, but they live a jolly good life because that brings me to the theme of today, namely diversity. So that's why I wanted to clear this, that you are not hearing from anybody who is an expert on religion at all. But if somebody were to ask me to mention one distinguishing characteristic of Hinduism, I would say it's diversity. And within diversity, I would put in acceptance and accommodation. And all these together bring us to this diversity. Now, when I say diversity, let me take two or three aspects of that. There is doctrinal diversity, first of all. Namely, that, see, you all of you have this handout there, and from time to time I may make a reference to it, because otherwise you would wonder, why were we given this sheet and Mohan never made any reference to it at all? So just so that you would know that you got something that may be of relevance, I was going to refer to the second, their group, under some values clusters, the second half of the page. And the very first thing, A, is four paths or yogas to moksha. Now, yoga is a word that most Americans know, though there is more to it than just the physical aspect of yoga. Yoga has many meanings. One of them is a way, a pathway. Yoga also means to bring together. It comes from a root called yuj, since Elton intensively studied 1 year of Sanskrit, while I, as a student, very leisurely studied it. Now, there was nothing intensive about my study ever. But anyway, so the four paths or pathways are four ways of attaining moksha. And that one word I need to explain, which, by the way, is there in your first half of it. And I did, by the way, go through a revision of it. So when Elton got the sheet, it was not alphabetically arranged. And then I thought, How can a professor not do that? He calls it a glossary. So that's why I had to send him a second edition of it. So there is that word moksha, number three there in the first half of it. Moksha means really release from the cycle of reincarnation. It's the escape from a round of births and deaths. So behind moksha, there is already one assumption that there is for us more than one life and death. By the way, this is a common, by the way, concept shared also by Buddhism. The Buddha believed in karma, which again presupposes that karma is really action or consequences of your action. So there are two or three assumptions there, the axioms with which you start, both in Hinduism and Buddhism. Namely, there is more than one life and death. You have a cycle of lives and deaths, and every devout Buddhist and Hindu has one goal, to get an escape from this round of lives and deaths. Of course, you might legitimately ask, then what happens to it? I do not know. So a lot of Hindus, this is one thing, a lot of Hindus can live with what you call doctrinal ambiguity. And I have never lost my sleep, even for a moment, because I don't know these questions, the answers to it. One of my closest friends always asked me, we go in the mall to walk, and he has been disturbed by all these questions. He has been going to a Christian denomination, and he says, Mohan, if there is karma, means there is actions, consequences, how does one even start with karma or actions and so on? I said, I'm sorry, I don't know. But again, I said to him the same thing. It doesn't bother me at all. So what happens after the escape from this round of existences, I really do not know. It may be a kind of a peace beyond understanding that we reach. We just heard one of the Vedic shlokas, which is stanzas or lyrics, and you perhaps heard, even if you didn't get anything out of it, except that the word, one word, shanti, was being repeated. Shanti means peace. It is like, you know, I go with my wife, for example, quite often to the, say, Christmas Eve service. And then they all say, peace be unto you, and so on. We get Christmas cards, which says, with a little dove there, and peace. So shanti means peace. So maybe beyond the round of existences lies peace. But coming back to diversity. So there are, by the way, this will happen. I will be digressing, and then we'll perhaps never come back to what I was talking about. By the way, I have a friendly suggestion here. Never invite a professor to talk to you and give him or her 15 minutes. That's the greatest punishment that you could give to a professor. They can't talk about anything for 15 minutes. It takes them to warm up 15 minutes. But anyway, so I will do my best here. So diversity. So diversity I mentioned, and I said under some values clusters, the second half of that page, the very first thing is there are four paths to moksha. Now that we all know what moksha is, and there are four ways, one is called knowledge, which is called jnana yoga or jnana marga. By the way, I'm going to throw some Sanskrit words and some short sentences on purpose. Because if I confess that I'm not a theology expert, or I don't have a PhD in comparative religion, why am I here? I should be on that side and not here. So if I throw some Sanskrit expressions here, at least there will be some credibility in your eyes for me that at least this guy knows a little bit of Sanskrit here. So that's why I'm using these. I'm not expecting any of you to remember those Sanskrit words even for a moment after I utter them. But that is for my credibility. So there are four paths to moksha. There is the path of knowledge. And here knowledge means the knowledge or the idea that our individual soul is of the same quality, is the same in some essential ways as the cosmic soul. And there, again, I'm going back to the first term in your glossary there, Atman and Paramatman, the same as Brahman, some people call it Brahman, that is the individual soul and the cosmic soul, C capital, are in essence identical. So this knowledge And again, this knowledge, I assume, is not just an intellectual understanding. It perhaps goes beyond that. And again, I'm not privy to it. I don't know what that really is. But this is what they mean by Jnana Yoga, or the path of knowledge. That's one way of reaching Nirvana, as the Buddhists they call it, or close to it, or Moksha, the release, as Hindus call it, release from these existences. The second path is the path of action, Karma Yoga. They call it Karma Yoga. We'll come back to karma in a little while. Devotion is the personal reverence, the personal worship of your chosen god or goddess. So it's called Bhakti Marga. And four is renunciation, giving up everything. Sannyasa is what they call it. So we have the Jnana Yoga, the path of knowledge. We have the path of action, Karma Yoga. Then we have the third path of bhakti or devotion, bhakti yoga. And four is sannyasa yoga or sannyasa marga. I'm almost using the words yoga and marga means path synonymously. So yoga has a lot of meanings, and that's your number six in the glossary. I don't need to read that here. So diversity, already there is a diversity in the paths that you choose to get your summum bonum, so to say. To get your, what the goal of life is, namely the release from this existence of lives and deaths, the round of lives and deaths and so on. So there is this doctrinal diversity, and it is accepted. You can choose any path you like. Also, I mentioned at one point under devotion number three that you can choose your own deity you like. Ishta Devata in Sanskrit. Ishta means desired. And devata means a deity. And by the way, devata is a word which is in the feminine gender. That itself, I'm mentioning, means that we have gods as well as goddesses. And that's very important. By the way, I like goddesses more than gods, partly because when I came to the United States, women were nicer to me than men. So I thought, if gods and goddesses are like us, then goddesses must be even nicer than gods. By the way, this tone, you are going to regret at the end of the 15 minutes. Why did we call Mohan to come and talk when he has this kind of attitude, partially humorous, partially not irreverential, but I really can't very seriously talk about it, because that's where my second point comes. As I said, there is doctrinal diversity, which is accepted. Nobody has fought in all the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years of Hinduism, because somebody said, hey, I believe in the path of knowledge, while you believe in the path of action. We have to fight with each other. Nobody fights over that at all. Again, I said, I like more, I was partly kidding, I like goddesses better than gods. No Hindu has ever fought with me on that issue. They think, okay, if you like whatever god or goddess you like is fine with everybody else, you devote, you worship personally those. Here we have a painting by Mark McGuinness, right? And you could see that. On those corners there are many gods and goddesses there. Some people would say that they are the manifestations of one god. Just now, the paragraph that was read from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where it asks you how many gods are there, the very fact that he goes through all the numbers. If there was a long treatise, he would have perhaps gone from one, or the backwards actually, from like 330 million, and then come finally to the answer of one. But even here, and this is my individual interpretation, and I cannot really overstate, I cannot underline it enough, that the way, what I'm talking about Hinduism is really my own interpretation. And then you would say, well, everybody interprets any religion the way they think it is. But in Hinduism, I need to overemphasize, or I cannot overemphasize the point that in Hinduism, it's even more important, because not only that there is the individual slant, individual interpretation that comes in the commentary or interpretation of anything, but because there is already a lot that is there, more than one. There is not just one Old Testament and the New Testament, but there are many sacred writings among the Hindus. So there again, there is diversity. There is not just one sacred text, O capital, but there are many that have the status of sacred texts. Just to give, again, another personal twist, there is right at the center, Mark has put in Krishna, the blue, that bluish god. By the way, saying that he was blue is maybe a little bit of euphemistic way of saying that he was dark. You know, it perhaps sounds better for some people. Blue is better than dark or black. But whatever it is, there is Krishna in the middle. Then there is, if you look to your left, there is the elephant trunked god that you see. He is my favorite. Because, of course, elephants are cute. But apart from that, he is the son of another god called Shiva, S-H-I-V or S-H-I-V-A. So Krishna is one of the avatars. I'm using the word avatar, by the way, in its Sanskrit meaning. There was a movie called Avatar, some of you would say, eh. There is no eh, by the way, in any of the Indian languages. Avatar. So avatar means manifestation. Avatar actually literally means from a root. Ava plus thru means coming down. It's like come on down. Remember that game where somebody is at the top platform and then he's asking them to come on down from the upper reaches down there the same way. Ava plus thru is the verb form, the root. And then avatar means a manifestation, something that comes down, meaning from the heavens to the earth. This Krishna that you see in the middle there at the center is considered an avatar, a manifestation of Vishnu, like Shiva, another god. Actually, in one of the sacred texts of the Hindus called the Bhagavad Gita, which means the song of the Lord, there Krishna says that I am one of those. I come to the earth many times to get rid of the evil and make sure that good triumphs. I have, of course, always a problem about this, 100% good on the one hand and 100% evil on the other. That's not the way I think the world is. And in the epic, the big epic, of which the Bhagavad Gita is a part, there in that epic, because he's a poet, he makes the problem of good and evil more complex. There are characters there that have some good mixed in some bad or something like that. But that's again a digression here. I'm only saying that there are many gods and goddesses seriously believed in and worshipped, and nobody goes to war because they are worshipping a god that the other is not. But they all. So that's why two years ago when I was visiting, by the way, Elton, when my time is up, would you please raise that? Because I'm going to go on like this. And the only one point I hope I make at the end of the 15 minutes, diversity is the soul of Hinduism. There is the doctrinal diversity, as I mentioned. There is the diversity of paths. There is the diversity in reality of many gods and goddesses that are worshipped. As I was saying, 2 years ago I went to India, and my cousin and we were walking, and every time there was a little temple, then he would, reverentially fold his hands, namaskar, namaste. I would be doing it also, not because that I was believing in all, every god that we were hitting there on our way. It's just that I thought, well, why not? I mean, it doesn't cost me much to do this, and I did that. But the point is, nobody in the long history of Hinduism ever fought wars on this issue. While we all know, at least you know much better than I do, that Protestants and Catholics were at each other's throats for at least 200 to 300 years. And when your ancestors came here, they made a truce. And that's why we have this freedom of worship and no laws about religion should be made and so on. But they learned this because their ancestors were fighting for 2, 3, 4, I don't know how many hundred years were going on. As soon as Martin Luther posted his 93 or 95, something 90 plus, protest there, it all began. So diversity, doctrinal diversity. In reality, in practice, many gods and goddesses also being believed in and being worshipped, that another, and so on. As a result, acceptance, and not just tolerance, there is a difference, not just tolerance, acceptance, accommodation, and therefore diversity, a positive aspect. That is what is, to my mind, the one most distinguishing aspect of Hinduism. I was going to make one more point, 3 minutes, and that's the last point I'm making. And I'm not going to develop it, but I'm going to just kind of plant a seed here. To my mind, and this is not perhaps an original thought, I may have read it elsewhere also. All of you know India is a democracy. It is the largest democracy just because we have a lot more people. But it is, to my mind, to me, there is a correlation between Hinduism and democracy. Because if democracy is accepting viewpoints that are different from yours, not killing each other because there are viewpoints, staying in the same assembly, Congress, and at least talk to one another in a civil way, if that is what democracy is about, then to my mind, Hinduism's diversity makes it a very good case for democracy. And I'm going, I may say that, and some of you may not like this, I think India's democracy is in some ways better, superior to the democracy of the United States. I'm going to stop here. A radical thought, some of you may not like it, but that's what you get when you bring a professor. You don't know what you are going to get. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks again for inviting me here. And I hope that whatever I said would make some sense. Diversity is the word. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you for what sustains us materially. We have time for a couple of comments or questions, and I'm going to ask Mohan if he would come back up here. If you have questions, please wait for a microphone.
On the handout, under the values clusters, number A, there's four paths to moksha without a definition, but on B, the fourth goal is release, which you say is moksha. Can you give us a larger explanation of what moksha is and why release is important? Release from what?
All right. Well, thank you. If I understand the question, what is really moksha and what is it a release from? The idea apparently, that's why I said, there are some axioms that one goes from. There are two other possibilities there, is that coming back to life again and again, at least the Buddha said, was a result of unfulfilled desires. So it could be considered as a total release from unfulfilled desires. So once there are no desires, there is no reason to come back to life. Of course, the karma theory stipulates or implies that you could come to another life, not necessarily as a human being. You could come in any form. But to come back to the way I can answer it is that moksha is the release really from a life of continuous craving, incessant craving or desire, and once those are gone, then that's where you have got release. Then there is no reason for you to be coming back, suppose, to the earth again and again to fulfill more of your unfulfilled desires and so on. So this is the way I see it, moksha, and that's why it's quite close to nirvana that the Buddhist concept is. Does that explain any?
Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine life without some kind of hankering.
Well, that is good. Well, again, if I may again go back to what the Buddha said, hankering is fine Because if we didn't have any desire, the only path would be to commit suicide as soon as we are born. It is immoderate desire. The word, I think, in Sanskrit that is used is trushna. Trushna means immoderate desire, while kamana might be just simple desire. I don't know. I'll leave that question of derivatives and etymology to Professor Hall here. But the point is, yes, there is hankering is fine if it is moderate. Actually, moderation is what is important. And that was a concept that I don't think the Buddha was the first one to express. So moksha is a release, and there also may be a kind of a hidden assumption that life is, there is a lot of sorrow in life. Actually, again, you would wonder, here I'm supposed to talk about Hinduism, why am I going back to the Buddha all the time? But partly because maybe there is a similarity there. When there were the four noble truths that the Buddha talked about, out of which, if I recall, the first three were not very nice, really, old age and death and things like that. So release from the existences, the round of lives and deaths, we have to axiomatically believe that it's a good in itself. If you don't believe that, then you just throw it away. As actually I didn't get to it, but Elton, when I was talking to him once at Barnes & Noble, had implied that I should say this, that in Hinduism the diversity again lies in the fact that you can believe, you can be a total materialist, they call it in Sanskrit Jadavad, total materialist, you could be an agnostic, you could be an atheist, and still nobody would question your being a Hindu. And that's why one of my professor friends once wrote a half-humorous handout for my class on India, and there he says again, a Hindu really is one who calls himself or herself a Hindu. There is no other really valid definition that you can point to, and so on. I know that I haven't answered it, and I'm afraid now all my answers would be like this. No enlightenment at the end of any of the answers there.
We have to conclude.